Good afternoon. I guess it's still morning in your time, but where I come from, we really have no time. I have to tell you that when I was invited to come here, I was pleased to have the invitation. I was pretty confident that you would invite me here to speak about some of my successes. But when I discovered that it was Father's Day, I realized you had the wrong man for the job. You see, if you do not know me, I realize that I come from long ago and far away, and so you probably do not recognize me, but my name is King David. I suppose if you had invited me here for President's Day or Veterans Day, I would have plenty to talk about. I mean, after all, I was, without trying to sound immodest, I was a great military leader. I led my people for 40 years, and prior to that, I established myself, even as a young man, as a man of bravery, a man who could lead an army. Even as a teenager, I went up against the great giant Goliath, the champion of the Philistines, and in God's name, I slayed the giant. And so from that point on, I had established myself as a military man. And when I became king, I continued my exploits. I led a personal force of 500 men, but at one point in time, I had an army of nearly 250,000 people under my leadership. No, I was a general. Some would say a great general. And that I could speak to you about, that I could say something, but fathers. If you'd ask me to come and to speak about being a statesman, that I could do as well. You see, I took over my country when it was floundering, when it was in chaos following the reign of King Saul. People in that day didn't know where to turn. They needed leadership. And I stepped in. I found the nation sand and I left it marble. Under my leadership in Israel, the nation established law courts. We established the Levites and the singers in the temple. I organized them. We made sure that there was a secretary for agriculture under my leadership. I made treaties with surrounding nations. Many things that I did helped establish our nation. Again, I know it sounds like bragging to tell you all this, but the historians themselves would call my reign the golden age of Israel. And under this facade of a general and a statesman, there beat the heart of a poet. A man who loved music and loved poetry and loved the arts. And I even was a musician. I played this instrument. It was called the rubaba. It was a one or two string crude instrument. And it was barely able to express the passions of my heart. And so I invented new instruments. And I wrote songs. Songs that you have in that book in front of you. Not a hymn book. You call it your Bible. In the book you call Psalms. Some 73 of the Psalms that are written in your Bibles were written by me. Now I had a passion. A passion for God. Passion for music. If you'd ask me to speak about that, that I could do. But you invite me on Father's Day. My greatest failing in all of life was my failure as a father. So what can I say to you today? Well, I suppose maybe not all of you know the story of my family. Not all of you may be familiar with the story of my failings. But there was a time in my life at the zenith of my success as a king when I chose not to go to war. I felt secure. The nations around me were no longer a great threat. And so when kings normally go out to battle, I sent my generals. I knew it would be fine. It was merely an excuse. I was lazy. I was self-indulgent. In my middle years, I decided I needed a break. And one day, as I was in my palace, overlooking my kingdom, I looked out and there was a woman. She was bathing. I looked, and I looked again, and I decided that I wanted her. And I called her to my palace, and I invited her to my bedroom, and we had an affair. Kings, leaders have their ways of keeping things quiet. And I thought I'd managed to do that. I thought this was something just between me and, we'll call her B. But I discovered that it wasn't. Because I discovered that B became pregnant. And I wondered what I was supposed to do. I thought if I could arrange for her husband Uriah to come back and spend time with her. He was on the battlefront. Thought he could be brought back and they could have a weekend together. Perhaps he might think and the world would think that her pregnancy was his doing. Little did I know that Uriah would be a man of far greater principle than his king. And he refused to have a weekend with his wife while his fellow soldiers were fighting, and he didn't go home. When I realized I couldn't cover up my sin, making people think this was Uriah's child, I came up quickly with a plan B. It wasn't well thought out, but it was the only thing I could think of. I decided that if I could do away with Uriah, then as king, I could marry whomever I wanted, and I would marry his widow. So I told my general to put him at the front lines, and I arranged for the armies to draw back so that Uriah was killed. It wasn't cold-blooded murder, but it was murder. It was premeditated, it was planned, and I thought I had covered things up. I took B to be my wife, and I thought it was all taken care of. But you know, those secret things that take place within your home are things that maybe few other people will know about, but frequently your children are the ones who know. And so it was with me. The actions that I took of adultery and murder are inexcusable. And they ruined my life and my family. You see, I learned something about God in the process of all this. I learned that I may be king, I may be the monarch of the country, but the only sovereign is God Himself. And you don't break God's laws, you only break yourself on them. And when you ignore what God says, You do it to your detriment and your destruction. Now God, in His mercy, forgave me for my sin, but nevertheless, there were repercussions for my failings. Repercussions in my kingdom, repercussions primarily in my family. I had one daughter. Her name was Tamar. I can't say that I knew Tamar as well as a father should know his only daughter. After all, I had 20 children. But I can tell you this, Tamar was a beautiful young woman. She was attractive in everyone's eyes, and she was a father's pride and joy. But Tamar not only caught the eyes of those outside the palace, she also caught the eyes, not due to any provocation on her own, just from her natural beauty. She caught the eye of Amnon, her half-brother. And Amnon wanted Tamar. He saw her, and he was determined to have her. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? He plotted and he arranged to be together with her, even though she wanted nothing to do with any improper relationship. He pretended to be sick and he invited her into his room to help him. And in a moment of vulnerability, he grabbed her and he raped her and he forced himself upon her. And my darling daughter suffered the consequences of that violent act the rest of her life. And as her father, I did nothing. What could I do? Amnon had behaved just as his father had behaved years before. What right did I have morally to step in? I did nothing. And so Tamar's full-blooded brother, Absalom, was determined to seek the revenge that was never meted out on Amnon. Absalom plotted his half-brother's death. And he took his time. 2 years passed by before anything took place, and then one day at a fall festival with all of the family gathered, Absalom murdered his brother, half-brother Amnon, and fled. It was awful. And I felt there was nothing, no high ground that I could stand on, nothing I could do. And Absalom, for all he had done to break my heart and to further divide my family, was a young man of extreme ability. He was handsome, as handsome as any man in Israel. And he was sharp. People saw him and they looked up to him and they followed him. And because he looked the part and he acted the part, he began to negotiate deals. And he got people in my kingdom to follow him. People in my kingdom who owed him aligned themselves with him. And soon, Absalom had a following of his own. No small following. He had split the kingdom and he decided to rebel against me outright and he marched into Jerusalem. It was a full-fledged coup. What could I do? I had two choices. I could stand my ground in Jerusalem and fight against my own flesh and blood, fight against my own countrymen in a civil war, or I could flee. And so I took those who were on my side, and we left Jerusalem in a hurry and turned it over to Absalom. Because I couldn't stand the thought of a civil war, and I couldn't stand the thought of anything happening to my family. And so I left Jerusalem and I went to Mahanaim on the other side of the Jordan River, and I thought perhaps Absalom would be content to have most of the kingdom. But he knew he could never be the outright king if I were still alive, and so he pursued me. And one day in the forests of Ephraim, the tragedy befell him. I had gotten my generals, Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, and I had divided the forces among them, several thousand troops for each of them, and they were to defend the nation. I insisted that I would go out and I would fight with them, but they said, "No, King. You're too valuable. If anything happened to you, it would be all over." But secretly, realistically, I think my generals believed I was compromised. I think they believed that I didn't have the guts for this fight. That if I stood face to face and toe to toe with Absalom, I could not hurt him. Could not defeat him. And so they told me to stay put in Mahanaim until the fighting was over. Once before, I had waited behind when I sent my generals off to fight. When that happened, I fell into my deepest sin and failing, and now once again, I'd sent my generals off to fight, and I had only to reflect upon the consequences of that failing. I waited anxiously, not really sure what I wanted. I wanted our forces to win, but not at any cost. Not at the cost of a bloody civil war, and certainly not at the cost of my son Absalom. When I sent the generals out, I said, "Be gentle with Absalom on my behalf." Little did I know how the fighting went. There across the river in the forest of Ephraim, the trees are thick. And as Absalom was riding his mule, his mule ran under a low-hanging branch, and it just happened to catch him in such a way that it pulled him off of the mule, and his head was hung from the branch. He was very much alive, but he couldn't extricate himself, and Joab came along and found him hanging there. And even though he knew my orders, he also knew as a military man that there would never be peace as long as Absalom lived. And so he put three javelins through the heart of my son. And before he died, his 10 armor bearers beat my son to death. I waited at the gate, wondering what would happen to my nation, wondering more than that what would happen to my family, and more specifically what would happen to my son. And as I waited, I saw off in a distance there was a messenger, and he came running, and he came to tell me news of the battle, and I asked him, "How did it go?" And he brought me news of victory. But I wanted to know more than that. I said, "Tell me, how did it go with Absalom? How is my son?" The messenger feigned that he didn't know. He said it was all confusing. There was so much going on. I don't know. And there off in the distance, I saw another messenger, a Cushite. He didn't have the roots in my culture. He didn't know the pain of this battle to me. And when I asked him, and when he showed up and I asked him how the battle went, he told me we had won. When I asked him about Absalom, he said, "May all your enemies be like that young man." And I knew my son was dead. I went up to the city gates, and there at the city gates, I wailed like a woman in mourning. "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son." Would to God that I had died instead of you. "Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." You say, what is the value of this reflections from an old king? Well, I have to tell you, there were lessons that I learned. They were lessons that I learned too late. But in this Father's Day, perhaps they might be lessons that would be of some value to some of you. You see, I learned the importance of a father's influence. I learned it far too late. And I had far too many excuses to recognize it at the time, but I see it so clearly now. In our laws, the key law, the Shema that we recited as Jews, said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength. These are the commands of God that I give you this day. Impress them upon your children. Talk about them when you are at home, when you are walking, or when you rise up, or when you lie down, or when you get up. Impress them on your children." How can you do that? Unless you spend time with them. And when did I, the king of Israel, have time for my sons, my daughter? I mean, our family life alone was complicated. 20 children, 7 wives, many concubines, giving each of them a piece of my life left little time. It was an impossible situation. Except, as a king and as a statesman, I was often called to step into difficult situations. No, I'm a responsible person. If I had really wanted to make time for my family, I certainly could have done better than I did. I realize, and you must realize as king, there were so many things that called out for my time. You men and women live very busy lives yourselves. You know all those things that crowd your schedule. Those things that keep you from the primary priorities in your life. My problem was I never really stopped to recognize what those priorities were. Leading a kingdom, governing, making decisions, leading a military force, it was so demanding. And in my busyness, I had no time for my children. When he was little, my son Absalom never could come to me with a broken toy. It's a little surprise that when he was older, he would never turn to me for a broken heart. I realized that my children needed my time. I realized it way too late when it was impossible to do anything. But perhaps it's not too late for you. But there's more than just a father's influence, a father's time that we can give to our children. We can give our children our example. I gave one example to my family. My son Absalom followed pretty closely in my footsteps. Results were disastrous. That command to impress God's commands on our children. If you want your children to follow God, they need to see you following Him. You can't simply point the way and say, "Do as I say, not as I do." No, your children will do as you do. So it was with Absalom. In a year of my life, when I turned my back on God and on everything that I held dear, and I wandered off to the far country to indulge myself, my son Absalom followed me to the far country. I came to my senses, and I asked forgiveness, and I was restored in my relationship with God, but Absalom never returned. Each of us as parents needs to think of the example that we have for our sons and our daughters. It's not simply a matter of sending them to church or telling them what they need to do. They need to see your life and see the difference that God makes in your life. If only my children had seen that in me. Well, I know you've heard enough of my failings. And the ramblings of an old man get old, but I just want to impress upon you today the importance that you have. It's past time for me. My family is gone. But let me tell you this. When it comes to making these decisions, time is not your friend. Oh, it seems that you have a lifetime to influence your children, but all of a sudden, the days that go by so slowly pass and you realize it's been a decade, 2 decades. And those little children are now grown and your opportunities are now squandered. Time is not your friend. So make time. Make sure that in your date book that you put in time to do things with your son. That you schedule a date with your daughter. That Your children are your priority, and it's demonstrated in your date book. Make sure to give them first priority. Give them your time. And then I was going to say, be a good example for your children, but that's not really the best way to put it. No, I would say, just be. Because if you are following God, your children will see that. They will follow in your footsteps. And you will lead them into a relationship that is much stronger than my children ever experienced. That day when the messenger brought me the news of my son's death was the worst day of my life. I cried out, "Oh, Absalom! Absalom, my son, my son." Would to God that I had died in front of you, instead of you. And I meant that. That day I would have died for my son. But what I realize now is that I needed to live for him. And that's a much more difficult thing to do.